So I want you to think about for a moment, maybe the most breathtaking place that you've ever like seen, you've ever experienced live, you've gone and visited, somewhere that just a picture could never do it justice, or maybe it was like a bucket list kind of situation and you finally went and gone and visited and it just blew you away. For me, I've gotten to see a few things. One of the benefits of my parents being from a different country is I've gotten to travel a decent amount. But for me, one of the things that immediately comes to mind is in college when I got to visit the Great Wall of China. It was, I don't know if anyone's ever been to the Great Wall of China. It was unbelievable. I was in college and a group of us went from our church and it was unlike anything I'd ever seen before. I mean, to think that they built this on this hilly terrain and you can get to certain vantage points where you can just see for miles. And I wanted to show y'all a picture of myself there, but it was before everyone had an iPhone. I think I had a digital camera. I don't even know where those pictures are, okay? They're in some file somewhere on some hard drive, but it was unbelievable. It was beautiful. You can see different countries. I mean, it's really amazing. Did you know, I just recently found out, you can leave a Google review about the Great Wall of China? Did you know this? Like, you can give it a star rating from 1 to 5 stars. Do you know this? I thought if you were one of the 7 wonders of the world, you get exempted from that. But if you go to Google reviews, and don't do it now, do it after, okay? Take my word for it. The Great Wall of China currently has 4.3 stars. Context, the Chick-fil-A closest to my house has 4.4. Like, if you are one of the 7 wonders of the world, you should get an automatic 6 stars out of 5. I mean, like, what else do you need to be? And what's even funnier and crazier, there's a couple of the reviews that you can find if you scroll long enough through the thousands about the Great Wall of China. Okay, I want to give you a couple. These are real reviews from people about the Great Wall of China. Here's one Google reviewer. Not very tall or big, just saying, I kind of liked it, sort of. I want to know where this person grew up vacationing. Do you know what I mean? Like, what are you used to seeing? Or this one, I got one more. And this one, I didn't make these up. I'm not that witty. These are real. And it gets worse, okay? This review is so crazy, I broke it up into 3 parts, okay? I say he because I assume it's a guy, okay? I don't see the hype in this place. It's really run down and old. I'm not sure, again, what you were expecting, sir. But he goes on. Why wouldn't you update something like this? I don't know, because it's not functional anymore, you know? And then, I'm not making this up, y'all. No USB plug-in or outlets anywhere? Are you kidding me? Man, those are way funnier reading with all of you. It's crazy. And that's an extreme example of something that I've always been so fascinated by. That there's actually research that shows, you probably heard this, that as humans, we are more likely to leave negative reviews about something than positive reviews about something. And there's actually brain science behind it. That our brains, we have stronger emotional reactions to negative experiences than we do positive experiences. That when something doesn't live up to our expectations or we see something that just isn't what we thought it would be, our brain actually has a stronger emotional reaction to the negative than the positive. The negative emotion lingers longer, which is why you're more easily satisfied and more likely to talk about it, share about it, or write about it, even on Google about the Great Wall of China. Now, you might not be the person that's like, you're gonna leave reviews, and I get that, but you know this, you know yourself probably well enough to know that we just have this natural bent as humans, and maybe you would call it a bad habit, of seeing the bad, of focusing on the negative, and being overly critical. And whenever we are, we're really good at pointing it out, letting somebody know, or talking about it to somebody else. It's like we're all just naturally wired with a critical eye. The negative outweighs the positive. And in some instances, we're like looking for the negative when something doesn't live up to our expectations or measure up to our standards, right? We're critical because something should be better. And ultimately, we're critical of something because we think it should change. Now, that's not always bad. I'm all for constructive criticism. I think that is good. I'll talk about that more in just a second. But the message today isn't about constructive criticism, which can be helpful for us as humans. Today, I want to spend a few minutes talking about how you and I have a natural bent towards fostering a critical spirit that I believe is a liability. That I can be so critical, I know firsthand how much of a liability a critical spirit that I foster can be, especially when that critical spirit enters into the realm of our relationships. That we're critical of them because they don't measure up to us. We're critical of them because they aren't living up to our standards, because they don't believe like we believe, because they're doing it wrong. We're critical of them because we want them to change. And so as we conclude our series today, the last game that I want to talk about is the change game. The change game. We all play it. I want to talk about it. We're concluding a series today called Games We Play, where we're talking about games that we play relationally. Now, I'm all about games. I love games, and I think you should play games to win. In fact, if you want to hear about how badly I like to win games, go listen to part 3 of this series. First 5 minutes, you either love me or you hate me, but you're going to learn that I love to win games. Okay, games are fun. That's awesome. But this series is about an arena of life where we should never play games. An arena of life where we should never bring games into, and that arena of life is an arena of our relationships. That games have no place, have no helpful or healthy place in any healthy or thriving relationships. Here's why. This has kind of been the big idea for the whole series, that a game that requires a loser is a game nobody wins. And in the relationship, the win is the relationship. And you know this, whenever you win the argument, whenever you win in the relationship, you lose. In fact, you end up losing more than the person that lost. There's regret, there's pain, there's collateral damage that you gotta fix, you gotta apologize. And in some instances, the damage seems irreparable. And we've talked about the blame game, we've talked about the comparison game, and today I wanna talk about the change game. Now, for all of us, we all live on both sides of the change game, meaning we've been on the side where somebody wants us to change and we're on the side where we want somebody else to change. My wife can give you a laundry list of ways in which she wishes I would change, okay? Ranging from my follow-through on a home project to how I chomp my popcorn, okay? It's pretty vast and I'm working on it, okay? But we all are on different sides of the change game with different people, different relationships, with someone you're married to, with somebody that you're raising, with somebody that you work with somebody that you lead, with somebody you're roommates with, right? We've all heard, we've all said, we've all thought, you should fix that. You should work on that. They should stop doing that. They should start doing that. And again, I'm not talking about constructive criticism and constructive feedback, because here's what's true for all of us, okay? We all can think of ways in which we need to change. We all can think of ways in which we need to be better and healthier. And in fact, I'm gonna talk about this in just a minute. We need people to help us change and to see the ways in which we can be better. But the tension in this message today, and the tension around the change game, and the change game becomes so toxic, not because change might be required in you or in me, but specifically, the tension is when you and I foster a critical spirit that misses the heart of God towards people and hurts the relationship. It is far too easy for us. In fact, it is so easy for us that it should give us a moment for pause. It is so easy and far too easy for us to recognize and identify ways in which we think other people should be better. It's so easy. It comes so naturally, it should scare us a little bit. That is far too easy for us to identify things that people should start doing, stop doing, should have done, should do differently. And before you know it, you and I, this has come so natural to us, that we will foster and develop a critical spirit, don't miss this, that will turn into construction materials for a moral high ground that we stand on, looking down at other people. And from that moral high ground, you are superior and I am superior. And from that moral high ground, the value of the other human made in the image of God is secondary to the issue that we think must change. And so we look down on people because we want them to change. They're not measuring up to our standard. They don't believe like we do. They don't live as we do. They don't vote like we do. They don't parent like we do. And so they should change. And we look down and we make sure they know it. And you know, if I could just be honest for a second, you know who the worst at this is? I'm gonna just step on our toes for a second. Christians. We can be so, and not you guys, right? You guys, y'all are perfect. But come on, Christians can be so bad at this. Religious people can be so bad at this. In fact, we take our faith and we take our Christian beliefs and we use that to build up this moral high ground where we're looking down at other people. And what that does is it breeds self-righteousness, and it's why, again, not you, but it's why Christians can often be seen as mean or harsh or judgmental. In fact, you might be in the room today and it's a miracle that you're at one of our churches or tuning in because you've had that experience with another Christian. And the sad thing is we build up these moral high grounds in the name of Jesus, who never came to look down at other people, but he came down in order to win people. The change isn't the issue. The spirit with which we bring to the other person is the issue. And Jesus spoke directly to this. But in his most famous sermon that we have recorded, the Sermon on the Mount, and it's in Matthew 5, 6, and 7. In Matthew chapter 7, he speaks to this directly. In fact, Jesus dealt with it specifically. Okay, whether you're a person of faith or not, you've wrestled with the tension of the change game. But Jesus, he dealt with religious people that played the change game in a toxic way, that carried a critical spirit and looked down on those that didn't get it right. And so in Matthew chapter 7, starting in verse 1, Jesus, part of this sermon, so he looks at all the people listening and he says, "Do not judge." Do not judge. Now, this verse tends to be very often misunderstood, okay? If you've been a Christian long enough, you've told someone, "Don't judge me," okay? We've done that, we've been there. What Jesus is and isn't saying here is really, really important. Here's what he's not saying with this word. This is a very specific word. He's not saying that we should never talk about what's right or what's wrong. He's not saying that we should never speak the truth in love. He's not saying that we should never have space for conversations to help other people, or that we should never invite conversations where we can be helped about what's beneficial, what's helpful, what's hurtful, and what's not. This word judge is not about what's right or what's wrong. This word specifically, the word judge, it specifically is communicating, relating to an attitude of superiority when we criticize faults, jump on other people's failures, and condemn other people without a loving concern for them as human beings. That to judge in this context is walking in with a critical spirit, on the hunt and on the ready to find and to point out the fault in others. And it's not because we care about the person. It's because the issue has become primary, and from our vantage point on that moral high ground, the humanity of another person is now secondary. And this word judge, it's in the present tense, and the idea means don't make it a practice of, something that we are so good at making a habit of. Don't make it a habit of carrying a critical spirit where you are so quick and so harsh and so mean as you point out and jump on the faults of other people. And Jesus, here's what he's saying, okay? To judge in this context, to judge is to be critical before you are compassionate. to care about the issue first before you think that there's a human on the other side of it. To judge in this context is to be legalistic rather than loving. To adhere to a law to such degree, to adhere to theology that you actually lower the value of the human on the other side of you. To judge is to choose religion over the relationship. To let what you believe and what I believe get in the way of building a bridge of relationship in order to share what we ultimately believe is best. And if I could just maybe sum it all up, and this might sound extreme, but just this is what Jesus is saying, this is not me, okay? To judge is to leverage the Christian faith as a weapon against people rather than a bridge to people. That it should not be the thing that gets in the way of us. It's the thing that should create a bridge of love and grace to other people. And what Jesus combats, you read the Gospels, you'll see this over and over and over again. What Jesus combats left and right in the Gospels are Pharisees, these religious leaders, the religious elitists that lived up in their ivory towers, judging with a critical spirit how nobody else measured up to them. And with the Pharisees, if we could learn anything from this, is so important. It no longer became about the law of God. It became about their own egos. That they were measuring people up to themselves more than they were the law of God, and they thought they were doing it perfectly. And there was no real concern for the lives of other people or for their hearts or for their faith. And that's the tension of the change game. And Jesus says, no, do not judge. Again, it's not about what's right or wrong, and the issue isn't the change. Don't bring that spirit into this conversation. And he says, I love this, he says, do not judge, or you too will be judged. Now this word judged here, it's interesting. The verb form, it's called a divine passive verb form, which means it's used when it's talking about a divine being. And so the idea here is not just that you will be judged by other people. We'll talk about that in the next verse. But what Jesus is saying, hey, don't judge with a critical spirit. Or guess what? God will judge you the same way. James, the very brother of Jesus, he writes in his letter later on at the end of the New Testament, judgment without mercy will be shown to anyone who has not been merciful. The Pharisees judged without mercy. And come on, Christians, and this is me too, okay? My critical spirit, I've got to bring that to Jesus on the daily. Christians, we think we're doing God's work, but when we're judging without mercy, we are missing his heart. This should freak us out. This just shows how big of a deal the mistreatment of God's people who are made in his image, regardless of the issue, is to God. Then Jesus goes on, he says in verse 2, for in the same way, and now he moves away from the divine passive form of the verb, and it's a general term for judge. For in the same way that you judge others, you will be judged. And with the same measure you use, it will be measured to you. Whether it's God or people, I think it's probably a combination of both. How you judge others, you'll be judged by the same standard. How you judge others, you'll be judged by the same measure. So let me just ask you a question. How do you want to be judged? When, not if, when all of us, when the time comes for somebody to call us out or to call me out, when the time comes for somebody to hold you or me accountable, to challenge us, right? To tell us how we can be different or ways in which we are doing it wrong, ways in which we can be better followers of Jesus. When the time comes for that moment to happen and it is necessary, how do you want that conversation to go? Do you want that feedback laced with a judgmental attitude where they're up here, you're looking up and you feel less than? Or do you want it to be brought to you in love, mercifully? Do you want that person coming to you because they care about the issue or because they care about you and that's why they care about the issue? Do you want that person coming in yelling from the ivory tower or in humility? I don't know about you, but I tell you how I want to be judged. I want that person to come to me in love, mercifully because they care about me. And just a few verses later, as Jesus ends this section, I'm gonna jump ahead for just a second, maybe kind of like his big summary bottom line of this whole sermon. He says it in verse 12. We're gonna jump down 10 verses, kind of concluding this section. He says, so in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you. For this sums up the law in the prophets, right? The golden rule in context, kind of bringing it all together. Judge unto others as you wish to judge unto you. In other words, I want you to judge others the way that you would want them to judge you. Bring issues and things to others in a way that you would want it to be done to you. With grace, with love, caring about you. And then Jesus, he uses this imagery to just show us how toxic this is, okay? If you've grown up in church, you've heard this. He goes on in verse 3, right? Sermon could have been done right there, but he says this in verse 3. Why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye and pay no attention to the plank in your own eye? A speck is a small piece of wood or chaff, sawdust. A plank. It is a large piece of building material. Okay, this is not your standard 2x4 in the Greek. This is like a load-bearing beam used to structurally support a house. We did our best Chip and Joanna Gaines impression a number of years ago, and we renovated our first floor. We took down 4 different walls. They brought in 7 or 8 big LVL beams with the columns to structurally support our house. Jesus saying, why do you focus on the speck in someone else's eye when you've got a construction grade LVL beam sticking out of your eye? And Jesus here is using rabbinic hyperbole to drive home his point. Why do you focus on the flaw in somebody else, conveniently ignoring, not even noticing or being aware of the plank in your own eye? And the point of Jesus here is not degree of sin. He's not saying the speck is less of a sin than the plank, and the plank is a bigger sin. It's not about the degree of sin. The hyperbole is meant to communicate this, that our tendency to fail to see our shortcoming as we judge other people is a bigger deal to God than the speck that we see in somebody else's eye. And you know how we do this? You just be honest, you don't have to just raise your hand, but come on, we do this. It's because we feel like the speck is in our eye and the plank is in their eye. Theirs is the bigger issue. Theirs is the problem. Yeah, I might have my, but mine's the speck. I mean, it's just bothering me, but they can't even walk. Jesus asked a rhetorical question, but come on, that's why. And then he goes on, he says, well, come on. He says, how? How can you say to your brother, let me take care of that small little speck in your eye, when all the time there is a plank in your own eye? It's actually kind of comical. Because the answer is, you can't. How can I be so critical and so condemning and so mean and so abrasive and so reckless with my words, so harsh with what I say, with what I comment, with the fault and shortcomings of somebody else, and I've done no work or have no concern for the plank or the shortcoming or the sin in my life? And then Jesus, he says a word that we hate. Don't get mad at me. I didn't say it. Jesus did. I'm just the messenger. Jesus says, you know what that person is? You hypocrite. You hypocrite. Conveniently ignoring or not noticing our own fault as we point it out in others. Holding other people to a moral standard that we don't even fully adhere to ourselves. Judging other people with a critical spirit, but expecting a gracious spirit if somebody came to us, Jesus says, you hypocrite. And there's kind of two things here that kind of come together that make this so toxic. It's our ignorance and our arrogance. Our ignorance of our own shortcomings and our arrogance that we think we have full knowledge of somebody else's. So, Tamer, you said it was good to help people to change. Does that mean that we should never hold anybody accountable? Does that mean that we should never speak the truth in love? Does that mean we should never try to help somebody? Does that mean I have to be perfect before I try to help somebody? No, no. In fact, look at what Jesus says next. This is so brilliant. Jesus, he was such a brilliant teacher. Look what he says next. He says, you hypocrite. First, there's an order to things. First, take the plank out of your own eye, and then you will be able to see clearly to remove the speck from your brother's eye. Jesus isn't saying that we should never help our brother or sister or our neighbor with the speck. He's saying that first, take care of the plank in your own eye, which starts with having a full awareness that it is even there to begin with. This is so helpful. We need people in our lives to help us and to correct us and to grow us and to challenge us and to hold us accountable. But Jesus is saying, before you enter into that category, into that territory, make sure you have full awareness of your own shortcomings, okay? Two images here to kind of drive this home, okay? Here's what Jesus is saying. That we are really, really good at holding up the magnifier. The magnifier is what we use to judge and to evaluate others. And we love holding this thing up, okay? These come with LED lights now. I mean, you can see everything with these things. You can read a book from a mile away. Jesus is saying, we should spend a little bit more time walking around with a mirror. This is what we are to use to judge and to evaluate ourselves. And the order matters. The time you spend with each of these matters because it will change your and my motivation with which we approach somebody and the spirit with which we approach somebody whenever there is something that someone needs to change. And we love to hold up the magnifier, don't we? Come on, we love this thing. It feels powerful, right? Sherlock Holmes, Jesus and Sherlock Holmes meet. Like, this is us. We're on the hunt. We're on the ready to find the fault. In fact, for some of us, we love to see the shortcomings and the failures of other people because it's an opportunity to pounce, an opportunity to show that we're right. In fact, not only do we every chance with him or with her or with them, do we jump on the opportunity to find and point out their faults, but we'll even look for them. We'll keep score. We'll remember what they did or what they said. And on the ride home, you are gearing up or you're waiting until they get home and you're like at the front door like this, I am ready to go. Do you know why we're so prone to hold up the magnifier? I think there's three reasons why we're, probably more, but here's three that I could come up with, why we're so prone to hold up the magnifier. One, as we've mentioned, because we have an elevated view of ourselves. We just think our religious belief can so often, if you're a Christian, make us believe we're better than, or just, come on, it's just a pretty natural human instinct, something broken in us to make us think we're just better than somebody else when they are not doing it in our eyes the way that they should be doing it. An elevated view of self. If I could just be frank for just a moment, do you know another reason why we are sometimes prone to hold up the magnifier? Because we have a secret or unconfessed sin that nobody knows about. And I'm not saying this for everybody, but sometimes a judgmental, condemning, or shaming, or angry, or harsh spirit that we show towards another and their faults sometimes is a sign that we have some secret or unconfessed sin in our own life. And oftentimes, it's the same thing we are the most harsh about in somebody else. And so in an attempt to deflect our personal guilt and hypocrisy, we focus on it and somebody else. And lastly, we're prone to hold up the magnifier because of misunderstanding the very heart of God. That Jesus did not come into this world to get anybody. Jesus came into this world to give his life as a ransom for many, to win people to his way, to win people to the love of the Father, to win people to a better way following him. And the longer that you and I hold up the magnifying glass, the more judgmental we become, the more legalistic we become, the longer we hold up the magnifier, I'm just telling you, your capacity and my capacity for compassion shrinks. and the longer we hold up the magnifier, our motivations will be so out of line with the heart of God and the way of Jesus that we will actually do more harm to the kingdom and the relationship than good. And come on, this is hard. But the longer we hold up the magnifier, we'll start to believe that we're the ones that change anybody in the first place. It's like we're the God in somebody's life. And forget that He just asked us to be a vessel of truth. We're not the one that does it anyway. So Jesus says, first, put this down for a moment and pick up the mirror. Pick up the mirror. The only way to stop playing the toxic change game is to pick up the mirror. And I'm just telling you, the longer you hold up the mirror, the more aware we become of our sin and our faults and our shortcomings. And you know what that will do? It will begin to soften our hearts towards others. It will lead you and I to have way more grace and way more compassion. Not necessarily less truth, but a lot more grace in it. That your empathy will grow the longer that you look in the mirror. The longer you look in the mirror, the faster that moral high ground that we've constructed begins to crumble. The longer we look in the mirror, the more time we are willing to take to earn the right to be heard, rather than assume everybody wants to hear us. And the longer we hold up the mirror, we will begin to foster an attitude that says, I love you enough to want to help you and tell you what's not right. And tomorrow, I'm gonna need you to help and correct me as well. The longer we hold up a mirror, the longer we'll buy into this, that our hearts should break for people before our minds judge them. And you only get there when you spend more time with the mirror. So what does it look like practically, other than walking around the mirror like this? What does it look like practically to hold up a mirror? Three things. I want you to write these down. The first, honest self-examination. Like honestly, asking yourself, spending some time with a journal or on the notes app on your phone or thinking about it on your ride into work. How can I grow? Where can I grow? Like what plank am I ignoring? Is there anything that I have not come to grips with? What changes do I need to make? And I mean unprovoked, just doing this just because it's a good exercise. What sin do I need to confess and bring into the light? God, what are you trying to teach me in this season? Where are you trying to grow me? Number two, time in the scriptures. This is the best mirror, y'all. The life of Jesus is the best mirror. The character of God is the best mirror. The more time you spend in the scriptures, the more time you spend learning about the character of Jesus and seeing the way that he interacted and learning about the character of God, it will grow your awareness of how much growth you need, how much growth I need, and how short we actually fall of the standard. But the beautiful thing about Jesus is that was never meant to make us feel bad about ourselves. In fact, what it will do, it will grow your gratitude for the grace that you've been given and increase your ability to extend that to those around you. And then lastly, inviting accountability. That's how you hold up the mirror. Inviting means you can't get defensive when. Ask for feedback and listen when you get it. Ask what it's like to be on the other side of you. Hold up the mirror. And this is so important, okay? Here's the point. The more aware I am of what God has yet to do in me, the less judgmental I am about what he has yet to do in you. Yeah, we've all got stuff that needs to change. And God's gonna put people in your life to help you see the things that need to change. For me, it's my wife, it's my best friends, it is staff that I work with, it is mentors. I've got people in my life left and right that give me feedback in ways that I could get better and should change. The difference is in the spirit within which we approach people and see people. And the more honest I am with the mirror, the more helpful I can be with the magnifier. That in those moments where we do get an opportunity to speak the truth, to help our neighbor, to be honest with our friend or with our spouse or with our accountability partner, to call out the sin, to call out the fault, to call out what needs to be different. Like, God's gonna put you in the path of people where you're gonna help their faith, you're gonna help save their marriage, you're gonna be a big part of what God's gonna do in their life. And if you're gonna be most prepared for that moment because we love people, spend more time with the mirror so we can actually represent Jesus well with the magnifier. Because the good that you and I offer to people in this realm, I believe, hinges upon our full awareness of the goodness and graciousness we've received from God. And we're gonna forget about it, unfortunately, without the mirror. And the more time with the mirror, that is the difference between being helpful and hurtful. More time with the mirror is the difference between being constructive and destructive. And it is ultimately the difference between building up and tearing down. So, what do you walk around with most? Come on. Just be honest with yourself. And maybe today this question is more relevant than it has in recent memory. What do you walk around with most? A mirror or a magnifier? Because the truth is, the gospel of Jesus is that we have all fallen short of the standard of God. And he came into this world not to hold up the magnifier in a way of condemnation. He came and he laid his life down. He died on the cross for your sins and for mine, and then he rose again to rescue us from the way of death so we could follow him in the way of life. We didn't earn it. It was all by grace. And for the Christian in the room, that death and resurrection, that gospel of Jesus, it still covers our sin and forgives us today and forever. And there might be some of you in the room or watching. You have been wrongly judged by a Christian. It's a miracle that you're here or you're tuning in. And I just want you to hear, I'm so sorry. I have not got this right every time. I'm so sorry. You've yet to really hear God's heart for you. That Jesus died for you. He gave his life on the cross and he rose again to rescue you from your sin, not to rub your faults in your face. And he came to die and rise again to save you so you could follow him along a better path, to experience a full life, to live in his love, and to ultimately be a light to those around you. So, we will be the church this world needs us to be. You will be the Jesus follower that your family and your workplace and your schools and your community needs you to be. When we spend more time with the mirror than we do with the magnifier. The gospel of Jesus, come on, it is so good that it deserves for us to get this. Let me pray for you. Heavenly Father, would you just, for a few moments, would you give us clarity and an awareness of how much we have fallen short of your standard? And in that moment, I pray, Lord, that it would not be because we're looking for a way to, the impetus wouldn't be because we need to feel guilty or feel bad, but would you give us an awareness to remember of how good you are and how gracious you are and how loving you are towards us. And may that be the impetus and the motivation and the conviction that drives us to represent that to those around us. May this moment right here be a moment for all of us to decide we're gonna change things, but first in us. We're gonna change the way the church is viewed and the reputation of the church. We're gonna change the way Christians are seen, and may that change start with us, because your way is too good for us to get in the way of somebody seeing how good it is. So help us see clearly today. Help us love well and give us opportunity to show people how good the way of Jesus really is. But may it start with us. It's in Jesus' name that we pray. Amen.